Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
The idea of the symbol of the moon, la luna, meaning not just light, but light bearing and light reflecting, an action verb. The moon is not a noun in this sense. We've been taught nouns are people, places, things, so on. But with regard to the moon, it's an action verb. It gives its name to matters regarding dynamic interior time and an active transformational process through its cycles. We don't note that the sun goes through cycles. We only note that it appears to not be here during our nighttime and that it rises in the morning of our days. But the moon, we see literally, changes from a little boat, a little coracle, carrying all manner of stars across the sky. And then it becomes, in many ways, a scoop that might be used to dip water. And it becomes a moon that appears that is partly in shadow and almost round, like a belly, like a beautiful, beautiful sky as seen from outer space. And then its fullest full, seeming perfectly round. Again, like everything in this world that is circular, that moves in a cycle, that rolls forward and backward, sideways, left to right, a circle, much different. I mean, can you imagine if our moon was square? Wouldn't that be interesting? No? Just take a bite out of it, and that would be the quarter moon. And the half moon would look like a rectangle. I mean, but these bodies are round, like the psyche is round. It's rounded off in many, many ways. It's soft on its edges in many, many ways. It is porous, in a sense, and it too reflects light from another source. What source is that? Well, Carl Jung called it the self, which is his word for creator or for God. Now, we can call it la que sabe. We can call it source without source. We can call it any number of things, higher power. We can call it by any of the ancient names of the goddesses and the gods. But the point is that it is a source of light that is reflected through us. In other words, we are the moon ourselves. And we are bright often, and then we are half in shadow, and then we are almost disappeared in cycle after cycle in terms of the way we live our lives. There's a time and a place for everything. So one of the dearest leitmotifs of the moon that I know is the lunare. It's a precious bone in the human wrist. It's shaped like a tiny half moon. And this little time traveler bone touched down in each of us when we were being made in our mother's uteruses. When my youngest daughter was born, I wrote a poem about how this little time traveler, this little baby, touched down carrying 23 moons inside her body, 10 tiny moons on her fingertips, 10 tiny moons on her toes, 2 crescent moons inside her limber wrists, and 1 full moon in her belly. Let this child on earth find all the suns needed to light these moons within. Let this child on earth find all the sunlight needed to light these moons within. May she know, Creator, may she know la que sabe, the light. May she know la luna. So, luna is also the name of the graces that are the Luna Maria, They're these lowland seas, they're called seas, that appear as dark areas on the face of the moon, and many of the seas carry names that are similar to the fourfold stages of transformation. The new moon maiden, the full mother moon, the outrageous thinking crone, the contemplative mysterious one, and they have their names, and they are Mar Injini and Mar Fecundatas. So fecundatus is to be fertile. And Lacos Somniorum and Mare Tranquitatis, and Tranquillo, meaning the sea of tranquility, the sea of new geniuses, the sea of the fertile, and the sea of dreams. And all of these are considered cycles that go all the way back to the ancient goddesses who have ever, ever, ever taught us about cycles. So you see the pattern. You see the pattern here. The light of humanity is a part of the moon cycle, not just as individual people who are lit up by a source without source from inside of us. The light of humanity and the biosphere that we inhabit, each of us lives in a different biosphere depending on where we live on the earth. The greenery, the trees, the flowers, the herbs, everything around us is different depending on where we live. And so there are people who are called lunanauts, meaning they, in curanderismo, they travel to the moon in order to receive information about the patient before them. And they say that sometimes the santitos look like reinas, like queens, who are wearing the lunar crowns and who broadcast to the healer, telling the healer how to move, where to touch, where to press, what medicine to give, what song to sing, what story to tell to the patient. So the moon has played an important part in people's ideas, mythology, medicine across the entire world. So where I grew up, I learned the story of what we called alternately the stolen mother moon, or sometimes called the lost mother moon. When I was a little kid, in the winter time, when it was still that, you know, jagged ice and that drowning slush and that horrible color to the slush. I mean, it was yellow, it was green, it was brown, it was black. From the effluvia of the roads, you know, the roads were usually dirt roads and they were oiled in the summertime so that all of that would wash over to the side of the road. And then when the snow would fall, at first it would be pure, beautiful white. And then after a very few days, some melting would take place and be this sickly, dim green yellow color. But inside the what were called cracker box shacks and salt box, which were Cape Cod, they said, which we were way far from Cape Cod, shingle, they were four-room cottages. They were just put down on the land, sometimes just on a sill plate, often no basement with them. And the shotgun houses, which are just a house that has one room after another for three or four rooms and a doorway in the middle straight down the house, a very narrow house, is maybe 10 feet wide, maybe even 8 feet. And this new sensation would come over us because we were going to plant, not right now, but not too far down the road, we were going to plant. And so it was a time of managing the seeds. And it was these bone-aching winters where I grew up. I mean, seriously, walk out in the cold and you could have an instant headache because the cold was so fierce and just pierced right through your brow. These bone-aching winters, we kept what we call fire seed. On the fire seed is this very hot, hot, hot peppers. Red, little tiny, you would call them cayenne, I think, cayenne peppers. And thousands of these would be strung like long beaded curtains, and they make a sound very similar when you touch them and they sway. They would rattle, literally. And this treasure was kept in the sheds in the cellar, hanging from the rafters. And this seed was so valuable to us that we called it red gold. And it was descended. It had a genealogy to it. It was descended from the mother seed that was planted for hundreds of years in the old country. And the seed had been smuggled into America because when you came to America, you weren't allowed to bring any plant stuffs, as they call them. So it couldn't bring seeds or flowers or fruit or vegetables or anything of that nature. And so the men will wear a necktie and they will put a little bit of the seeds down in the very bottom pocket of the necktie, and the women would slit a little slit in the hems of their very voluminous skirts, and they would pour seeds in all the way through the whole perimeter of the skirt, which was substantial. And that's how they brought seeds here, as they smuggled them in because they weren't to be allowed. And yet for the Mojores and for the Schwabische people, they could not possibly live without hot peppers. This was like, they felt it was not only this tasty, tasty thing that, of course, to burn your eyes out if you ever touched your finger to your eyes after touching one of the veins of those peppers, but they felt it was also medicine, that every single day they put it on everything, and they felt that they were having really good medicine every day. And almost every one of them lived to be near 90 years old, so I have to say there may have been some really good truth to that. At any rate, we would start floating the seeds on a bowl of water to see, you know, what exactly was a good seed and what was a not good seed. And the seeds that weren't good tended to float right under the water line or fall all the way to the bottom. And the seeds that depending on which plant it was, the seeds that floated on the top were the ones that were chosen. But in other peppers that were like what you would call banana peppers, I think, long yellow curved peppers, big peppers, it was exactly the opposite. The seeds that sunk to the bottom of the water bowl were the viable ones, and the seeds that floated to top had a hollowed out, because they're much larger seed than the fire seed for the cayenne peppers. They were hollowed out, dried out, in other words, and that's why they rose to the top. So we'd use these old scissors. You know, the scissors have broken off ends to them that somebody had used for some job scissors were not meant for. I'm sure you have at least one pair like that around your house. And you'd take the scissors and you'd like cut little paper squares from these brown bags that we had. And then you would put the seed, just a certain amount, in each one. And then you would fold it up just the right way. And of course, they would all argue, all my relatives would be arguing about which flap goes over which first. And this, no, no, it's this one. No, it's the, I tell, no, we've always done it. That, you know, every year they would have the same argument. And they would tie string around these little packages. And then they would give them as gifts to other people, mainly neighbors who weren't Mojores. They weren't Hungarians. They were. I had never seen or heard this kind of hot pepper before. And they would keep a substantial number of those little packages and mark a big X on them, meaning these are good for planting. And so we took care to wash the essence of pepper oil from our hands with naphtha soap. That's rough. It's rough like a dog's tongue, naphtha soap, and brown like uncut mustard. And we would, you know, wash our hands afterward. And the old people said that the fire seed that we left drift from our hands into the openings we made in that good Midwestern black earth in the springtime was past its 100th generation. And the word that they would use in Hungarian and Schwabische, German, was not to seed the ground, but to inspirit the ground, helping it in us to remember all we need each other, that we need one another, we need our families, we need people near us who care about us, who like us. And they weren't afraid, you know, of the bulls in the field next door. They weren't afraid of the one-eyed goats or the swarms of night honeybees in the grass or the hunter hornets in the pine brush. They weren't afraid of anything. They just kept seeding their seed. Oh, we planted at night, and we planted under a certain moon. That, as they were told long before television, long before radio, long before there's no reading or writing for my family, they were understanding that there was a certain kind of light and blessing that came from Mother Moon. And so that's why the story that they used to tell about the lost Mother Moon was so poignant to them because it cannot be without the moon. She gives her blessing to the fire seed, the very medicine that they believed kept them alive. And so once upon a time, just down the road from our own village, which is always, you know, one or more yards away from something that's going wrong and something that's going right. It says that just behind your village, there's another little village, one that you might not see or you might not know about, but it's just like our own. It has people in it just like us. In fact, they look like us. They have children who look like us, and they have dogs that look like us, and they have chickens that look like us, and they have fields that look like our fields. And in that other village, in that perfect village, there are people who are kind and careful and affectionate with each other. And there are those who are hostile, or who are mean, and who are cruel, just like in our village. And all the people in this village dress and speak and look just like us, and except one day something happened that they never expected before. This village was in the middle of a lovely forest, but it was surrounded by a circle of the blackest, darkest, thickest, most muckiest, most suckingest, beige, brown, black bog. This dark and damp bog stunk to the high heavens. And the frazzle-headed, thick-waisted and long-toed plants there were always drowning or strangling one another. In the meantime, they were busily rotting away. But the old silvery-gowned woman lived high above the bogs, and her soft illuminations had shone down for centuries. And she was known as Ancient Mother Moon because of the many quagmires and quicksands there. The villagers depended on Mother Moon's light to guide them through the night. And the villagers thought of her in all of her phases as the most beautiful of all lights. And for thousands of years, she had watched over all of life from her cloud house in the sky. And she was the many in one, from the slimmest crescent to the full-bodied, all the way to the sharp scythe, to the dark cloaked one. And the people of the earth depended on her kindly light to lead them safely through these treacherous bogs back to home. And yet it was well known that in each month there were going to be a few days during which, when nightfall came, and three nights in a row, Ancient Mother Moon followed her cycle of temporarily darkening. She would draw into herself. She did not shine then, but on these nights the bogs came alive in the most horrible way. On those moonless, motherless nights, the things that lived in the darkest imaginings of human hearts and minds crept out. Then the bog creature's treacherous eyes glowed in the dark. And you could hear their screeching and calling to each other in the dark. And you could see the flash of their claws in the dark. And people were afraid. And they stayed as close to home as possible. And during the last dark-filled time, several people had tried to cross the bogs at night for reasons no one knew, and tragically, all lost their lives. And when the newly born and noble old Mother Moon, who cared greatly for human beings, learned of this, of these deaths in the bogs, of the humans she loved, she resolved that when the next dark cycle of her time, her month, approached, that she would descend to earth and she would look into matters for herself and see what is happening here. Who is being so cruel to those whom I protect and watch over? And so, during her next moon cycle, the next darkening, she stepped onto a slow shooting star, and she landed with a soft thud at the edge of the great black bogs. And her dark outer robe was wound tightly around her beautiful old body, and the long plumes of her shining white hair were drawn back under her hood. But the tiniest rim of bright light glowed all around the edges of her beautiful old face, and only a little halo of brilliant light escaped from the hem of her robe. And thus, she came forward into the bogs, for as far as the ancient Mother Moon could see, the bogs lay shining black like a broken mirror, great jagged willow trees stuck up in sharpened pikes, and the smells of the slime and the muck were everywhere. A Mother Moon trembled in the cold and the fog, and from her long oversight, she knew the evil ones lived there too. But nonetheless, she began her walk through the bogs, her love for the souls of human beings. You understand? Her love for the souls of human beings was far greater than her fear of shadowy evil. And so, guided by the little golden light that leaked from her robe over her beautiful, beautiful feet, she felt her way along in the dark, and the mid dank ponds, in the midst of all else, they were dark, and the slippery marsh mires. All of a sudden, she thought she felt something, even as she something grabbed her by the ankle, a vine from a twining tree, but the twining trees were now under the control of the evil ones, and they jumped out, those vines, unwilling to break her fall, to protect her as they ordinarily would on a night of light, and she fell, and other vines set up tough ropes lashing around her arms and her legs and her waist and pulled her down, relentlessly down into the black muck, and she struggled. And she struggled, and she was mighty in her struggle, mighty in her muscular struggle. But the vines tightened and held her in the blackest dark, and the old moon mother, in the midst of straining and shivering, she cried out, but no one heard. And she lay silent, half buried in the mud. And from far off came a human's pitiful cry. Help me, help me, oh my God, help me. And the Mother Moon heard the splashing footfalls of a lost soul stumbling in the darkened bogs, and in the powdery light from the stars, she could just make out the despairing face of the traveler, and his eyes were large as saucers, and she knew the poor man was lost and was now, without realizing it, floundering deeper into the bogs, floundering to his death. And so, without realizing that she could never fully cover her light, She saw that the frightened traveler had caught sight of a glimmer of light escaping from the robe of the captive Mother Moon. And thinking it meant safety, he started making his way even faster across the bogs toward that light, thinking that it meant a beacon, a refuge. But an endless drowning quagmire lay between he and the light, and in horror, the Mother Moon realized that her glimmer of light was drawing the man to his death. Frantic to warn him, she struggled and she bucked against her bonds until her hood fell back and the dazzling white hair of her head was unleashed, a light that lit the black waters, radiant silver in all directions. And just for a moment, this caused the land to be lit as bright as day. And the traveler then saw the danger, and to his horror, he saw too the bands of evil ones dive under the water, smashing and slithering their ways back to their lairs, and the terrified man ran for solid ground at the edge of the marsh. And so relieved was he, and so quickly did he sprint for home, did not think to turn back to see the source of the sudden brilliant light that had saved his life, that miracle flash of light in the dark. And the Mother Moon, so fatigued, bowed her head, and the hood of her cloak fell forward over her glowing hair again, and all was dark. Exhausted, she ceased her struggles. She sank further down into the muckmires now. Her weary head fell onto her breast, and in the darkness, the vile things crept out. And I chanted, "Yes, now we shall seize you. Now we shall kill you. Now we shall douse this light once and for all." And they who hated the light, they who loved the putrid dark, they who loathed human beings, they who abhorred the souls humans belong to, all these now gathered around old Mother Moon, snarling and kicking and biting and stinging her. They threw twining webs over her. They drove the wounded moon down, down, down into the muck. This night, the ancient moon cried out over and over. Her flesh reddened from their blows, but no one heard her silvery voice above the creature's raucous noise, and they tore at her seamless white robes, trying to steal her light. But each time they tore a portion of her robe away in their claws, the light went out, leaving only a shower of ashes. Stripped of her robes, and now clad in only her luminous flesh, they drove the wounded moon down, further on further down, into the pit of mud and muck, and over the top of her grave. They pressed an evil mat of thorny vines, each thorn black as blood that had sat for days. And the evil one spat through the grid upon the Mother Moon, and they mocked her cries of pain. Oh, yeah. Cry out. And no one will hear you. No one's coming to help you. and she clung to the edges of the pit with her beautiful hands made of light. And she let one last ray of light escape from her heart. On this ray created a long, wavery road that reflected out over the watery bogs, but then, in full decline, she lost her grip, and slowly she sank, disappearing completely into the muddy tomb. And now, no more did the wise old Mother Moon light the dark waters, neither from heaven nor from the horizon. She who had given her light over eons and even more, the one who shone down on mothers nursing their babies, the one who caused dreaming women to kiss their lovers' backs, the one who put words into the minds of poets. She, the ancient source of light, is wounded, buried, alive, far underground. And the evil ones, they did not care about mothers or babies. They didn't care about lovers or poets. They cared nothing and for no one except themselves. And now, the evil ones rolled a giant boulder over the Moon Mother's grave, and they danced a crazy jig atop of it, and all night long they crouched and leapt and gambled, and all night long they shouted and screamed and careened about, drunkenly revealing and reveling in their own evil and base amusements. And this is how it sadly came to be that once this village, very much like our village, on that night, and on many nights thereafter, no sweet, loving light shone down from the sky. Now there was only unending dark, and poets and artists became uninspired. And their words and their ideas slipped away before they could even imagine them enough to sing them or write them down or draw them, dance them. People suffered greatly. Important promises were put off indefinitely because they would often close a troth or an agreement under the light of the moon. And people stopped planting. They stopped planting the very foods that they needed in order to stay alive, in order to feast, in order to have weddings and funerals, in order to do all the things that human beings do to be dear to one another. And they longed for the Moon Mother's light. They longed for her because she had alerted their hearts to beauty. She had bid them to comfort each other under the moonlight. And they longed for the ancient sound, the lovely sound, the thrumming of choo. It could be heard if one listened carefully as the Mother Moon rose from the horizon line up into the sky. The people yearned so hard, and for so long they all began to dream the same dream. Night after night, they all dreamed of the ancient Mother Moon. Madre la Luna, Madre, Madre, Mother, Mother. Donde está? Madre, where are you? Where are you, Mother? And so, finally, so forlorn, so forsaken, they decided that even the dogs did not bother to raise their heads as strangers shuffled by. Even the owls no longer flew at night. Finally, the villagers met and said, "We must do something." And they planned, and they schemed, and they said, "Well, maybe we could make candles of tallow and light hundreds of them, and this will cast a lasting light in the world at night." But somebody said, "No, the night wind will lash them out till they all die out. Well, maybe we could roll thousands of boulders into the bogs and we could fill them up and no more souls would ever be lost in them. But everyone knew there were not enough boulders in the entire world to fill up these kinds of bogs. Finally, near the end of their wits, they decided that no matter the risks, they would hold hands and they would venture out into the darkness, into the roiling bogs to try to find their venerable Mother Moon. And so some villagers armed themselves with sharpened hoes to pull aside the choking vines, and some carried torches to burn their ways through the tanglewood, and thus they all tramped out into the dark, hooked in elbows or holding hands into the dark that wise humans are wise to fear. And everyone could hear the vile things clattering in the background. Villagers. We'll take them too. They'll never survive. And so, shivering and wind-racked, this faithful group, like a tiny string of lights in the dark, they continued onward, and its feet sank into the black, greasy grass, and the hacksaw firm up to their knees, and their boots became heavy from the clinging, cold sponge mire. But they made their way through the dark, and the evil ones crept out and brazenly attacked, scratching, then withdrawing, poking and clawing, then withdrawing. And the villagers swept their fiery, smoking torches at them, keeping most of them at bay, but some villagers were wounded, and everyone could hear the vile things. So the little group, in search of their beloved, suddenly in the dim light, they made out a great boulder that was before them, not too far. And they consulted each other. Has this boulder always been in this place? I don't recall seeing this before. Not here. I thought I saw it somewhere else, but not here. Another said, no, I don't remember. Nor I. And they agreed something was different here. And just the tiniest salvage of golden light glowed around the edges of the giant rock. And with hope, the people pushed and pressed against the stone's face, and they tugged and they lunged and they backed up and they ran at the stone, and they gave it every effort, but the stone would not move. Finally, I said, let us all gather together at one end in a semicircle, and let us back up and run at full force, holding our hands out to push as hard as we can from the bottom of the stone. And this they did. They rushed forward and bent and pushed up against the bottom of the stone, and it rocked. It rocked in its place. And I said, push harder, push harder, put, oh, it was so hard to hold that stone. It was so hard. Push hard, hold on, push up. And this they did, and they did, and they did. And finally, with a huge groaning and slushing sound, the giant stone broke its seal with the earth, and it rolled away entirely, and the stunned villagers stared down into the pit, seeing the most beautiful olden face they had ever seen. A mound of purest, soft, golden light in which were set the wisest, most beautiful eyes, filled with utter understanding and love. The most undefiled face made of light they had ever seen. And as they called out, Mother, Mother, madre. The face of light began to rise up through the mud, and the net of thorns circling her head and shoulders fell away, and the manacles of vines around her ankles and wrists withered and dropped away, and her wounds sealed themselves right before the villagers' eyes, and nothing of death or darkness had sullied her, because love was alive in her. It was a burning light at the center of her very being. The mother moon, the ancient grace herself, slowly climbed higher and higher out of the bogs. And she walked with such grace across the waters, and then she climbed up to the banks, to the horizon line, and the ancient mother moon, released from her captors by those who loved her, looked back to where the dark was, and looked forward to where mother moon was, into the brilliant light. And she looked back at them with her beauteous face as she climbed higher and higher, nodding and rising up and up and even further upward, until she was seated high up in the night sky. And from there, with her face half turned toward the earth and part toward heaven, she presided. She sent her light to those she loved. Her beautiful, old, shadowed face of love shone down on those she so cherished. And so now, as in centuries past, sometimes she travels across the sky with her hood thrown back, and then her light is radiant in every direction. But then on other nights, her light is radiant in differing amounts. And on those three nights, every passage she still veils herself in gray. Even though darkened, she is present. The mother is present. And the travelers have learned to rest near their hearths during her time of darkness, to just rest, to go nowhere. For they've learned there's a time to go and a time to take repose. Then on those nights of darkness, the human beings have opportunity to turn inward also. They stay close and they take note of the lights of pure sweetness in their children's eyes, and they stay close and become attentive once again to the longing lights in their lovers' hearts. And the poets open their hearts to matters only seen in the dark, as do those who struggle, who may not have seen the truth of it in daylight. But if they inquire, and they're quiet, and they turn inward, and look, they will see in the dark points that cannot be seen during daylight. So, you might ask, are the bogs surrounding the perfect village now perfected because she is in the sky again? Are the bogs still there, or are they gone now? But no, the bogs are still there. They will always be there. Always. But is life, you know, in the bogs? I mean, will people ever be lost in the bogs again? Sometimes. Yes, sometimes. But you mean no matter what one does, no matter where one goes, the bogs will still be there? They will. They will be there. But still there, on here also, right now, with us, is the light of the great and ancient Mother Moon shedding that uncanny light for as far as anyone can see, us learning her rhythms to stay close, to shed light, and to take time in order to be darkened, in order to learn in a different way, in order to be with oneself and be at peace. Her light despite war and death, despite entrapment, wounding, darkness, has never, ever lost its life. She is the many in one, from slim crescent to full-bodied rondo, to sharp scythe, to the dark-cloaked one, to slim crescent, again, ever-born, ever-filling, ever-emptying, ever-reflective, and thus born again, ever-filling, ever-emptying, ever-reflective, thus born again. And therefore, all the people of the earth find in themselves her example of love, that the soul is led safely through the treacherous night bogs back to true home again. But I chose this tale because it's one of the best I know to reveal the concept, which is ancient, of the fourfold transit pattern of journey to strength and transformation. That idea at the very end about filling up, emptying out, reflecting on what was filled and what was emptied, and thus being reborn again with new ideas, new hope, new direction, sometimes new friends, sometimes new mate, sometimes new world, sometimes new life, that it comes as a result of a certain kind of consciousness that wants to blossom, wants to bloom, and uses wisdom as its source. Wisdom to see, wisdom to sort through, wisdom to create new ideas, new maps, to follow, keeping whatever parts of the old map work very well. And so when you see the gnosis of a woman's life, meaning in this case the what I would call the self-knowing, the la que sabe, when you have a sense of that in life, you can see it, you know, from these parts of the, you know, sui generis period of darkening. Sui, S-U-I, meaning self, self-mate, to have a unique consult with oneself is how I would put it to you. A time of being a class to oneself alone. You are the class and you are the teacher. You are the learner and you are the teacher both. On it, to be in that time period is a period that is the darkening. It is the place where one spends time in incubation in the dark, an interior journey. And a lot of times people who turn inward for a few days, 3 days, 3 hours, 3 minutes even, they find that they're suddenly inspired with different thoughts, ideas, images, sensations in ways that are very helpful if they will interpret them and then incorporate the best of them. That the darkening is a place where things happen. We've all been told that the dark is chaos, that in fact it was called that in ancient Greek and Roman mythology, that but also in Jewish thought, in also ancient Jewish thought, also ancient Christian thought, that the dark is a place of chaos, except that the word chaos doesn't mean all a jumble with everything going in all directions and all things not making sense. Chaos really means that there are forms within the chaos that are waiting to come to life. That it would be, in one sense, I think, that you could call it the unconscious. And the unconscious is filled with all sorts of things, but including the gifts that we carry that we have not yet brought to consciousness. And so that part of the darkening of the moon, of the beautiful mother moon, is very much with us, comes with us. Psychically, we're born to have these cycles. We're born. Women have a cycle of menstruation that coincides with the darkening as well as the other phases of the moon. Whether it's synchronized specifically with the moon, I think, is less important than the fact that the moon is teacher and that we are student, and that she has the la que sabe, but also there's something in us that rises up and says, you know, that sounds familiar. I think I'm going to see if I won't follow that. I even mark it on my calendar. I'm going to say, the dark of the moon is coming. Would that be a good time for me to reflect, to be inside myself, to be darkened in a sense to the outer world. The second phase of the mood, the kore period. Kore is also in Greek, it means maiden, but more than that, it means, in a sense, woman who does not or will not marry. Some will not make a conventional relationship. She will make a different kind of way of living. On that kore version of the moon, in the young crescent moon, is born as a sliver of new consciousness and light after having been darkened, where one is, you know, thinking, mulling things over, pulling things out of the dark, looking at them, examining them, turning them over, holding a candle up to them to see what they really are made of. And then the next phase is to bring it into consciousness, to bring it in some way down to earth, into this world, into your world, and to begin to think about what you want to do with that new consciousness. This is also called the waxing moon and the new moon, and it corresponds to the idea of an inspiration. An inspiration is an inspiration. It's not a done deal. Inspiration is sort of like, I think I have a great idea. Then the sliver of the moon, the little crescent moon, is the beginning of that idea being made manifest on this earth. I'm going to tell you that I'm not 100% that this is pronounced right, because I've only heard this word from curanderos that I was with at the borders of Mexico and the United States. The vetera, the means the old experienced one, and I don't know how to spell it, and I barely know how to pronounce it, but I understood what it meant. It's the crone, the wise moon, who lives partly in light and partly in mystery, both. And this is called the waning moon, as you know, and also known as the complete crescent. And all of these stages and ways of being are how we manifest on earth. Either we unmanifest something by changing direction or uprooting something or saying no to something or cutting or severing something, or we build something, or we bring things close to us that were not before, or we create art, or we create music, or create dance, or create in whatever way matters to us, create children, create relationships. So the crone, the vetera, is supposed to be the person who watches over not only from the world of light, meaning, you know, everyday reality, but also from what else might not be immediately seen, from the dark as well. La que sabe can see, remember, the past, the present, and the future. And so this is within us, these phases. There is a lot to be said about acidia. And acidia is a unusual and beautiful word. And it is in Catholicism that I learned it. And acidia is squandering, in a sense. It means to refuse to enjoy the permitted delights and pleasures that have been granted to us or are within our reach. Instead of enjoying life when it presents enjoyment, we go, no, I need to do something, dear. I just need to, you know, take care of counting the little dots in the acoustical ceiling or something like that. That's far more important. So that people put off, for instance, working in the garden if they love to do that. I mean, it all comes around once a year, right? And then other things come around other times of the year, but that ability to put your hands, especially in warm earth or early in the morning, you know, the birds are singing, you can be out there and get your knees all wet and get a cramp in your back. And yet, you know, flowers are going to come from it, you know. It's whatever it is you're planting, fruit, vegetables, beautiful ornamentals, whatever it is, changing things around, making it different. But, you know, you're busy counting the little dots in the acoustical ceiling, and so you can't possibly go out in the sun with a vitamin D throwing down on your head so that it gets to your pituitary gland and makes you feel better and happier and healthier. No, you can't do that because you have to count the dots in the acoustical ceiling. So that's one of the things that goes on. Another one that's really common is acidia, meaning putting off, squandering, you know, the beautiful things that are offered to us. Is, oh, I can't go out and listen to the birds after a rainfall. You know, I'm too busy. You know, I'm busy counting the dots in the acoustical ceiling. And so we miss these beautiful things. Mother Moon never holds herself back, nor does Lakesabe. They work in a cycle, and they move through the cycle, and they're rich, completely rich, in each cycle. People think, oh, the dark of the moon, nothing's happening. The void, nothing's happening. Chaos, nothing's happening. That couldn't be farther from the truth. It is a time to be alive in a certain way. And you can do that. We can all do that. And there will be testings. The testings are, will you really live fully alive as a person who's becoming an elder? What on earth are you going to have to tell the young if you don't live now? What on earth will you have a wisdom to give to other people if you're drowning in acidia? You won't. So you must. You must go out. You must have experiences. You must do the things that you're called to do. It is so nurturing to be under the moon and see the moon. When we were at Ghost Ranch one year, I said to everyone, I was teaching a retreat there, I said to everyone, all right, let's go out. We're going to take a moon bath. And so we all went out and we dragged blankets and pillows and we were all over the desert floor, just laying there under the moon. And then I would say, all right, time to turn over now so we don't get moon burnt. No, it's all turn over. And it was sweet, sweet. It's one of the best memories I have of human beings, is how darling they are in nature, how dearly they love the night and the sky and the stars and the moon. It was really, really straight into the heart of Lakesabe, the one who knows, the one who knows how energizing, healing, helping, sweet, sweet, sweet that is to take those times of life. And as an elder, if you have done that and you've done a lot of it, you'll have a lot to share with other people. And so may it be for you. The hardening off of the heart wood, it's a blessing on you here at the end. There will be in its first winters the inescapable hardening off of the softest cells around the heart of the tree, the parts nearest the tender soul. And this must take place. This must take place. For if it never, ever occurs, if one never learns to shelter against the clever cold, if one never passes through freezes nor storm, one remains a basic tree, unwritten upon, still wearing its original sign, lovely, but untested. But if one can hold on, hold on, hold on, while the ice hag rides by, she who pretends she is only an innocent form of water, yet sharpens herself into sets of sawing silver shears, if one can just hold on and resist and harden up in just the right ways that are tender and see it through, then one will be granted the legend earned by elders, beautiful courage tree, blessed life tree, mother tree, filled with light tree, she who has stood many winters, she who has been tested and not passed, but surpassed all expectations, even her own. And so may it be for you. And so may it be for me. And so may it be for all of us. Amen, amen, amen. And the little woman.